This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Andrew Park's son was three when he first uttered the word God. It was a wake-up call, at least for a dad who was raised in what he describes as a faith-free environment. That utterance required a reaction, a response. What followed is not a story about struggling with God, but one about struggling with whether to struggle with God. He resolved to go to extremes and to face this issue seriously. And he quickly discovered this process would become more serious than he could possibly have imagined. Andrew Park has written about his quest in his book, Between a Church and a Hard Place, One Faith-Free Dad's Struggle to Understand What It Means to Be Religious or Not. And he joins us for the hour to talk about his quest and about his book. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
You live in Chapel Hill now with your family, but you, when this occurred, and you're from Charlotte, it occurred in Charlotte. Your child was 3 years old, and you were living here in the city of churches.
That's right.
When he uttered the word God for the first time. And you, and I said you grew up in a faith-free family. What does that mean?
Well, it may not mean exactly what your listeners would think. My parents had both grown up in Christian homes, both grown up in essentially the Presbyterian church. But they had both become disillusioned and disaffected from those faiths as adults. And when they had children of their own, I think that they decided that organized religion was something that they were no longer comfortable with and wasn't something they wanted to bring up their children in. And so what it really meant was that we didn't go to church, we didn't talk about religion, we didn't read from the Bible, we didn't really have much conversation at all, at least I didn't, about religion. It was sort of a non-entity to us. It was something that other people did, and we didn't. And that really persisted for a long time. And so from that standpoint, yes, we were kind of faith-free.
So given that background that you grew up in and your own adjustment to it, even though we'll talk a little bit more about who your family is and what their religious background is later, but why did it come as such a shock to you when this word came innocently tumbling out of your child, three-year-old child's mouth, the word God? Why did it even faze you?
Well, because I think that at our core, as parents, we know that we have certain responsibilities. And one of them really is, I think, to, you know, answer questions for our children. And when you find that they are getting an answer to a question or learning about something outside of that relationship, then it gets very unnerving. And I had avoided the issue of what I believed and what I was comfortable with and what I thought the answers to these questions were, at least what the questions were, for a long time. My wife and I had both really avoided it the same way. With each other and with our children. And I think the same way that my parents had with me. So if there was panic, it was because I realized I couldn't exactly escape it, certainly not in the city of churches.
Yeah, you used the word panic, and your wife, in the book, you write about how your wife told you that when the word God came out of your three-year-old son's mouth, there was this look of panic on your face because you were confronting your own indecision or because you were confronting a topic that you really didn't know how to handle.
I think it's both, and that's not a position you want to be in as a parent. You know, you want to feel like you have the answers for your children and you're guiding them in the right direction.
Had you ever talked about, I mean, you said your parents, your family didn't really talk about it. Did you never bring it up? I mean, you're living in the city of churches. You obviously are around people who talk about God all the time. Mm-hmm. At the time you were growing up in Charlotte, PTL was on the air. Everybody talked about Jim and Tammy Baker. Did you never bring up the word in front of your parents? You never had any questions about it to your parents about what they believed?
Remarkably few.
Why do you suppose that was?
I think it has to do with a child seeing their parents' lack of regard or lack of interest in a particular subject. You mimic that, at least until you get to the point where, if you do get to the point where it strikes an interest with you personally. It just never did, and with me. And because of that, like I said, it felt like something that other people did. Other people mm-hmm. cared about, and we just really didn't. We also there were a lot of people I grew up with who were raised the same way, and so it was self-reinforcing in that way.
Well, you know, you turned out okay. You have a successful life. You're a successful journalist. Your wife is successful. You have a nice family. You've got two kids who are growing up in a good home. If it worked for you as a kid, then why didn't you just ignore it with your kids and move on? Just ignore it.
Well, because I think that that would be a disservice to my kids. Mm-hmm. They're growing up in a world where religion, like it or not, is still an incredibly important force, an incredibly important influence on the way people live, on the decisions that are made, on the peace or lack of that in the world.
But if you're faith-free, mm-hmm. as you describe it, so what? It doesn't impact you if you choose not to believe it or buy into it or be part of it. Does it really affect you?
Well, and I think that's the fallacy. I think it affects us all, no matter what we believe. And I think as parents, it's incumbent upon us to give our kids the tools to understand and make their decision for themselves.
Your parents were both academics.
Yes.
At a major university. why hide it? At UNC Charlotte.
That's
a
right.
Major university in the area. How many are there? Let me think about this. unfortunately, both of them have passed on. So you never really had an opportunity to talk to them about their beliefs mm-hmm. and about what decisions they faced about how they raised their children, you and your siblings. What do you think you would have gleaned from such a conversation?
Well, it's interesting. In thinking about and doing research for this book, I went back and talked to many of my parents' friends and contemporaries to try to understand better the environment that they were in and the decisions that they were making when they were in the position that I am now. I think that for my father, he had grown up in a harsh religious environment in the fire and brimstone of the Church of Scotland, highly Calvinist, kind of bleak environment. Mm-hmm. I think my father was made uncomfortable by religion, and I write in the book about how he never wanted to go on a walk again because that was something that they did in Scotland every Sunday after church, and he hated it so much that it made him never want to take a walk. I mean, that's really being affected by religion in a negative way. I think for my mother was more of a seeker and still had a fundamental kind of Christian feeling in her. She was also made uncomfortable by the Southern Church's lack of response to the civil rights movement. She was somebody who believed very deeply in social justice and equality, and as she was coming of age, she saw the church as a force that didn't live up to mm-hmm. what it said it was. So when it came to raising children, I think their number one goal was to be true to themselves and not to steer their children in a direction that made them uncomfortable.
And your wife is a lapsed Catholic, as they are called,
mm-hmm.
But you were both married under the auspices of a clergyman. You right. were married by what, a Methodist preacher, rather liberal Methodist preacher?
Yes, that's right.
And you sent your child, your son, your three-year-old, who said the word God that precipitated all of this, to a Methodist daycare center.
That's right.
Now, surely you knew that when you put your child in an environment that is operated by a church, that somehow, some way, someday,
right.
some religious influence is going to rub off, or he'll be exposed to that. So why did it come as such a surprise to you?
Well, I think it goes back to that desire to avoid the issue. You tell yourself that it's not going to be an issue, and you tell yourself that the only influence a child is going to have at that age is going to come from their parents, and that you can hang on until they're old enough to sort these things
right.
out for themselves. But you're certainly right. So it was a little naive on my part.
So it didn't occur to you before he uttered the word that this was going to be a problem? Because if it had occurred to you, would you have put him in a secular daycare?
Well, the funny thing is, my experience, and some of your listeners may have had the same experience, my experience is that 90% of the daycares in Charlotte are run out of churches, and that may be true everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's funny that there's so many of them where there is not a religious component. There just happened to be a very minor one in this case.
In the book, as when this word is uttered, when God is uttered by your three-year-old, you and your wife are sitting on the couch having a nice evening, and all of a sudden he says the word, and that gets your attention right away, and she starts to quiz him, and the answers that he gives back about who is God and did God make me sound very much to me like Catholic catechism that we learned when I was a kid. It sounded very much like that. So that means to me that that's where his information came from that daycare. Was it coming from other kids? Was it coming from teachers? Was it coming from his questions that he asked? Because he is a journalist's son. So he might be inquisitive.
Right. I think it was coming from the daycare and maybe also from friends. But you're right. These were kind of, he had basic notions about God created the world. God created us. Mm-hmm. You know, he said when we asked him probed a little bit deeper, he said, we asked him, how did God create us? How did God make us? And he said, well, God pops in our eyeballs and screws on our heads.
Sounds
okay.
Like a plan.
You know, yeah. I think that there is a basic comfort in that notion, and I think that that information is something that when you're 3 years old seems pretty darn explosive, pretty amazing, and something that you can really latch onto. And that's not to belittle the belief in creation. It's more to say, I think that kids are especially kind of wired to accept religious concepts, and I don't think that the things he was saying were probably that unusual. Mm-hmm. I think they were just surprising to us.
Well, you mentioned the word comfort, that there's a comfort to him at that age of understanding this creation story or having a creation story to think about. And there's another scene in the book that you are overhearing your child, your three-year-old, talk to his then infant sister, who's about one, in her bedroom about who God is, asking her questions like, did you know that God made us, and when we die, we go back to him, and isn't that so cool? That's very sweet. It really is. I mean, what was your reaction to that?
Well, you know, that's exactly what my reaction was. I thought, that is really sweet, and that makes me happy that he's got this feeling of wonder and comfort. But at the same time, it's a little disconcerting to know that it hadn't come from me as a parent, and it wasn't something that I had ever believed in myself. It made me really think about the question of faith in a totally different way. Because, you know, of course, children look at the world much differently than we do as adults, and often their sort of unfiltered view can teach us a lot. Mm-hmm. So I immediately could relate to that comfort and that wonder, and I appreciated it. I just didn't know how I was going to deal with it myself, and I think that's when I really knew I was in trouble.
Which led to the quest, which we'll talk about as we go through the rest of the hour, with Andrew Park, author of Between a Church and a Hard Place, One Faith-Free Dad's Struggle to Understand What It Means to Be Religious, and then in parenthesis, or not. There's an editor's dream. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is made possible in part today by the McCall Center for Visual Art, presenting an opening reception for Fried by Franco Mondini Ruiz. Friday, April 16th, 6 to 9 p.m., with a sales performance at 6:30 p.m. Information at McCallCenter.org. Tomorrow on this program, we meet the Carolina Chocolate Drops. They got together about 5 years ago to, I guess, keep going or revive a dying tradition, that of black people playing string band music. And since that time, they have gotten themselves a national following. They're coming into town to play, but they'll join us first tomorrow morning. And we'll also take a look at a local effort to save the oldest standing fire station in town, Charlotte's historic fire station number 2. That's tomorrow morning at 9.
President Obama plans to dramatically scale back NASA's human spaceflight programs. Former astronauts are divided. The future of NASA and America's role in space exploration. The Diane Rehm Show, Thursday.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-funded 90.7 FM, WFAE, your NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and our guest today is Andrew Park, who's a journalist, grew up in Charlotte, lives in Chapel Hill today, and is the author of a new book called Between a Church and a Hard Place, which is about his personal struggle in trying to determine how to deal with the topic of God with his young children. His son was three when he first uttered the word, and we talked about in the last segment how it kind of put some panic into Andrew because he had not prepared himself for what he was going to say. If your son had asked you directly, he didn't ask you this, I don't believe. If he asked you directly, do you believe in God? What would you have said?
Gosh, that is a great question. At the time, and maybe even today, I would have said, I would have hesitated. I would have said, you know, some people believe this, some people believe that. I'm not quite sure what I believe. And I think that's okay. What I'm trying to get to, I guess, in my life is a more definitive answer for myself, because I think it's important for children to see that this is an important issue for everyone, and it's something that even parents struggle with.
You know, you talk about a conversation that you had at some point in your life, and I'm not certain when, with a college friend.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this conversation took place when you were both in college and you were driving back from some place, and he was religious and you were not. And you asked him, I believe, why, what was the attraction? I'm paraphrasing here. And he said, well, it's the most important question in our lives.
Right.
You've suddenly realized that you need to find out an answer to this question.
Right.
It's the question that you didn't even understand what the question was. And now you're seeking an answer to that question.
That's right. And if I am to look back at my upbringing, I think that what I have trouble with in my upbringing is that in the kind of secular humanist worldview, we weren't really addressing that question. It's not to say you can't address the question in the secular humanist worldview. It's just that my parents sort of, I think, decided not to. And I think it's an easy thing to avoid when you are avoiding the topic of religion, to avoid a lot of bigger questions about our lives that go around that,
mm-hmm,
and revolve around that. And so doesn't mean that you have to take on a Christian worldview or a Muslim worldview. I think it's important, though, to kind of own up to what our worldview is and to have an answer to that question that you're talking about.
So are you an agnostic? Are you an atheist? Are you a non-believer or non-faith person, an unchurched person? How would you describe yourself?
Well, you know, I have my parents' aversion to labels, particularly religious ones. But I think, you know, two words that probably speak to me the most would be agnostic and humanist. I certainly was raised with a very humanist set of values, and I still hold most of those dear. But as the book points out, I'm not somebody who would say that there are easy answers to the question of is there a God or not. And I actually am turned off by those who would say with certainty that they know either way.
Your,
so I think agnostic probably sums it up best.
In your family past, you have people who were very closely attached to evangelical Christianity. Was it your grandfather or your great-grandfather who helped
My great-grandfather.
He helped found what?
The Pentecostal Holiness Church.
Pentecostal Holiness Church.
Mm-hmm.
And then your brother, who was raised in the same household that you were raised in, this faith-free household, has become, at some point became, an evangelical Christian.
That's right.
How do you deal with him?
Well, initially, his conversion to Christianity came when he was an adolescent. He was 17. He was a high school senior here in Charlotte.
Was it rebellion against your parents' worldview?
Well, That's a great question. I always assumed it was, and I think a lot of people assumed it was, and it's hard to imagine a more perfect teenage rebellion than going, you know, born again in a household like that.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, and what's been gratifying about working on this book is that it's allowed me to have conversations with my brother that we never had before. Mm-hmm. And he told me, and one of the most shocking things that he's ever told me, he said, you know what? I thought they were going to be really happy about it. He saw my mother as somebody who was, at her core, a Christian and somebody who would appreciate and be joyed by his decision to commit himself to Christ.
What was their reaction?
Their reaction was the exact opposite. Their reaction was the way you would react if your children were truly rebelling in a dangerous way.
So they reacted as if they had been an evangelical Christian family and their child suddenly became an agnostic or an atheist, they reacted the same way that kind of a family would have reacted.
Yes, they saw this as a betrayal of their core values, of everything that they had taught my brother. Mm-hmm. And it's not too hard to see why, if you think of the context of the times. This was the mid-80s. You mentioned the Bakers. The Bakers, I don't think, were ever particularly threatening to people like my parents, maybe embarrassing but not threatening. Mm-hmm. But certainly it was coming at the same time as the rise of the moral majority and the religious right, people who were gaining power in our society and were pointing the finger at secular humanists.
Yeah, it was their secular socialist attitudes that bothered your parents about these religious people. It wasn't their religious beliefs. It was their social, secular beliefs.
That's right. And that's right. And the conflicts that started to brew between my brother and my parents as soon as he declared himself a Christian.
Mm-hmm. Is he still?
He is still a Christian.
And this sets up an interesting family dynamic, particularly for you in the context of the conversation that we're having now and what your book is about, because I would assume that you want your children to have a relationship with their uncle. Mm-hmm. And here he is way out there. And you're on the opposite pole, and what do you say? As these kids become cognizant of other things in the world other than what happens in your living room as they grow up, how do they treat this man?
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with what he has to say to them about his beliefs?
Mm-hmm.
Tough.
It is very tough, and it's funny. That is a question that is really, to me, at the heart of this, because I'm somebody who is really thinking a lot about the human relationships and the human dynamic here. And I want my kids to have a great relationship with my brother and with his children. Now, fortunately, he's somebody who's extremely respectful of different belief systems and different views of the world and would never condemn my kids or proselytize to my kids, never has tried to with me either. I think I have a responsibility to my children to treat him the same way, to treat his belief system as equally as valid as mine, and to kind of model that respect. I think it's important to model critical thinking, but it's also important to model respect. It's the only way, really, we're going to coexist. There are a lot of people who are non-believers who think it's just a matter of time before this whole religion thing crumbles and we don't have to deal with it anymore in society, whether it's in, you know, American society or in world society. I think that's hogwash. I think it's a dynamic, a dimension of life that's going to be around
forever.
Forever. And our responsibility is to figure out how to kind of coexist. Otherwise, it all falls apart. Yeah. So, you know, I actually am happy to have those conversations now. It's something that certainly in the past made me a little bit nauseous, but I'm happy to have those conversations and show my kids that it's an important conversation to have.
These are tough conversations, particularly if you have questions, if you don't buy hook, line, and sinker into the dogma of whatever faith you have or don't have. I mean, if you're a Muslim or you're a Buddhist or you're a Hindu or you're a Christian, there's a dogma there. There's a set of beliefs. And if you don't believe it, when your child comes and asks you questions, it seems to me that you're going to have a pretty – you're going to be into that's the rock and the hard place that you talk about in the title of the book. Your daughter, we just went through Easter, your daughter at one point in time asked you why Jesus is the only human to ever come back to life.
Mm-hmm.
How did you answer that question?
Well, if you read the book, you know that I didn't do a very good job of answering it. It threw me, for sure. You know, there's two dimensions to this. There's one dimension, which is the theological, and I'm not real well equipped to explain that, even to a five-year-old.
Why not? Because even though you came from a faith-free family, you live in the world. You're a journalist. You went to college. You certainly, you can't escape Christianity in this country. You can't escape it. The story permeates our very existence. So you certainly knew the story.
Of course. But it doesn't take long for a child's questions to stray into territory that gets a little bit
philosophical,
unfamiliar, let's say.
Okay.
And, you know, and then the other dimension is belief. And so early on, when we were having these questions, my wife and I really stumbled upon the same response. And I think it's one that a lot of non-believing parents use, which is to say, well, you know, some people believe this. And that has a certain utility because it allows you to be in a kind of non-judgmental way, teach your kids about how different people see the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think, again, at the end of the day, children want to know what their parents believe,
yes,
and they want to see you take a stand. And it, you know, is something that I didn't actually really see my parents take a stand on until my brother's conversion, at which point they were really forced into a response, and their response reinforced for me that religion was something to be disregarded. It only kind of made me harder in that sense.
In this book, when you write about God and you don't use the word God, you say him,
mm-hmm,
the H is capitalized,
mm-hmm,
which is what religious people do.
Mm-hmm.
Is that out of respect? Is it because you're on the fence and you don't want to offend him in case he exists?
Sure.
What is that?
Yeah. We live in at least right here, and I have grown up in a Christian context. I mean, I consider myself culturally a Christian, the same way a lot of Catholics consider themselves culturally as Catholics.
Even if they don't practice.
Jews, even if they're not practicing,
yes,
culturally. I'm culturally a Christian. My great-grandfather, you know, was a leader in the Pentecostal movement. I can't really disown that tradition, or I'm not ready to yet. Now, do I really think that God is a man and should be referred to as him with a capital H? I don't know. Maybe it is just out of respect. I think it's also just out of the fact that this is the context that I was writing it. Charlotte's a very diverse city now. It was diverse when I was growing up here in the 70s, but you'd be hard-pressed to find a lot of practicing non-Christians.
Yeah.
This is a Christian, you know, kind of culture that we live in, and it's not to disregard other belief systems. But that was really what I was struggling with, was Christianity.
Andrew Park is our guest. He's a native Charlottean living in Chapel Hill. His new book is called Between a Church and a Hard Place. He'll be signing it at 7 o'clock tonight, by the way, at Joseph Beth South Park. The first utterance of the word God by your three-year-old led you to realize that you had to do some thinking about your own beliefs and what you were going to tell your children as the questions became more frequent and more dense in terms of their complexity. You talked about research, doing research, the obligation to do research to figure this all out. Where did you begin?
Well, one area that we've already talked about is my family tradition. Trying to understand my religious DNA, as it were. And I will say, one of the fascinating things to me was to look at how spirituality had ebbed and flowed. And ebbed and flowed is probably too mild a term. It's more like a roller coaster, up and down, mm-hmm. throughout the generations in my own family. I think this is really common in American families. We have this free market of religions, and every generation makes its own decisions, no matter how hard they are, influenced or indoctrinated as they grow up. So I say in the book, you know, we went from my great-grandfather, truly a holy roller, to my parents, you know, heathens almost. And I mean that lovingly, you know, and then back to holy roller with my brother in the space of a few generations. And that to me is fascinating. But again, I think I went and looked at a lot of social science research about the prevalence of church going, the belief in God in American society. And I think that's very common. Mm-hmm. Within that research, what's interesting to see is that I'm part of the first real generation of Americans who were brought up without religion, outside of organized religion. Yeah. For the first time in the late 60s and 70s, a decent-sized swath of the population here was being raised.
Well, you talk in the book, you give a lot of numbers in the book about where we're headed theologically in this country. And if you didn't do the research, if you just watched the media and heard conversations around you, you would think, because of all the rise of the mega churches and the televangelists, et cetera, you would think that, and the fact that some very vocal Christians are vocal about their fears that they're trying to be, people are trying to stamp them out, that you would think that there's been a rise in religiosity and certainly a rise in Christianity. And you say that that's not true. The opposite is true.
It really is. There are any number of measures over the last 10 to 15 years that show essentially a doubling or more of the size of the what they call the unaffiliated population in America. These are people who, if you ask them what their religion is, they say none. And in fact, a lot of times they refer to as nuns. And, I'm a proud nun myself. That population has gotten bigger. It has gotten more emboldened in terms of, acknowledging who they are and acknowledging their place in society. And it does go against the narrative that is so common that we're becoming more and more and more religious as a society.
What is it about the nuns, and not N-U-N, but mm-hmm. the N-O-N-E apostrophe S's, what is it about them? Is it that traditional churches no longer speak to them, that they become more educated and therefore have dismissed these creation stories and the stories that we hear in the Bible that are kind of foreign to people who are not religious in church? What's going on here? And maybe I have to come back after the break and get an answer, because we have to take the break. And so we'll do that. I'll give you a chance to think. Andrew Park, author of Between a Church and a Hard Place, One Faith-Free Dad's Struggle to Understand What It Means to Be Religious or Not. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is made possible in part by Community One, the bank that says, yes, you can, offering asset management solutions, retirement planning, and other trust and investment services on the web at myyesbank.com. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, President Obama plans to dramatically scale back NASA's Return to the Moon program to make way for implementing a new vision for the space agency. A group of astronauts led by Neil Armstrong opposes the move, but astronaut Buzz Aldrin, who accompanied Neil to the moon, and others believe it will propel the U.S. to the forefront of space exploration. So Diane Rehm will take a look at the future of NASA today at 10 o'clock at about 20 minutes from now. And if you'd like to join our conversation with Andrew Park, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. And we're back in 30 seconds.
WFAE has a new member benefit, Public Media Travel. Now members can help the station even more by booking their travel at WFAE.org. You can also connect with other public radio fans through over 30,000 travel blogs. Just click on WFAE.org/travel And when you purchase airline tickets or plan a vacation, a portion of the proceeds go to WFAE. Public Media Travel at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Andrew Park is our guest. His book is called Between a Church and a Hard Place. It's the story of his struggle to explain God to his son and daughter who have begun to ask questions about it. How do you explain all the nuns out there, the N-O-N-E-S's out there? What is it that makes them free? Or why is it growing, I guess, is the question.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple of things. 80% of people who identify themselves as unaffiliated, as nuns, are people who actually were raised in a faith themselves, which is kind of interesting to think about. You know, people who had a religious tradition that they grew up in and then they rejected it or have discarded it. I guess my wife would fit into that category. One of the theories that has been put forth, and I think is probably a pretty solid one, is that as the religious right emerged in the 80s and 90s as a political force with religion as its foundation. Mm-hmm. A lot of people who considered themselves religious but rejected the political views of the religious right started to question their religious commitment, their religious affiliation. They didn't want to be associated with a force in the world that was arguing for on that side of certain issues.
Okay. So it tainted their political points of view, tainted the religious aspect.
That's right, and sort of drove a wedge, pushing them more to an extreme that said, you know what, if that's what religion is, I'm not interested in religion anymore because I have these political beliefs. Mm-hmm. And so that certainly had to have played into it. And then I guess the other point is, in the last few years, you've seen some best-selling books such as The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins, God Is Not Great by Christopher Hitchens, best-selling polemics written by atheists that have I think, made it more acceptable in our society to say, you know what, I don't believe in God. You know what, I am an atheist.
You told one interviewer that you were because in the course of doing your research to answer your own questions, you talked to a lot of people. You didn't just go to libraries and dig up numbers. And you told one interviewer that you were impressed by the way most conservative Christians would talk openly with you about their faith, while those who were non-religious were sometimes reluctant to do so. Don't you think that's because it is still difficult, even though more people are more agnostics and atheists feel freer to come out of the closet, so to speak? Don't you think there's still a lot of social pressure on people to have some sort of a religious belief, or at least not to put down or dismiss the religious beliefs of others because it's so pervasive?
I think there's a lot of perceived social pressure, mm-hmm. certainly. That is incredibly common among non-religious parents, that they feel ashamed or embarrassed or unable to be open about their lack of belief. However, I would argue that in this diverse society we live in today, that is more perception than reality. Mm. I myself have never felt persecuted or put upon or criticized for my lack of faith. And you know, I live in Chapel Hill now, but I've lived in Texas and in North Carolina, certain places where there is quite a bit of religious activity and feeling. It's not to dismiss that atheists who are open about their lack of faith will not face resistance, a lot of times within their own families, mm-hmm. Or within their own communities. Not to dismiss that at all. I think that can be a very hard road to hoe. But I also think we have to be honest that this is, a pretty open-minded society from that standpoint. You know, I use the example of television. I challenge people to tell me the last, network television show that they saw where the main characters were churchgoers. You don't see it. You know, and when I was a kid, The Cosby Show was the number one show, mm-hmm. and the perfect representation of the perfect American family. And they didn't go to church except when it was with their grandparents. Yeah. So I think it's not I think it's more perception than reality, but it's certainly an important perception.
Did you, in your research, did you explore other religious beliefs other than Christianity?
For the most part, no, because as I said, this book was really about struggling with Christianity, which has run in a number of different strains through my life and my family life. It's not to say that there aren't, valid belief systems and ones that might even speak more to me, but I really felt the need to address this divide that I see than I felt between Christians and non-Christians.
Given the fact that you grew up in this non-religious home, even though you have religious background in your family, you don't do what some of the atheists or even stronger agnostics do, like for instance, Bill Maher, who's a comedian and is not a believer, raised Catholic, not a believer at all, and he calls religion a delusion.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do that.
Well, to do that would be to really disown a lot of my own family background. It would be to show remarkable disrespect for my older brother, the only remaining member of my kind of nuclear family. I don't think that's helpful. I think that, again, it's a reversion to the poles. It just polarizes us more. And I think as people who call themselves free thinkers, humanists, who call themselves open-minded, it's incumbent upon us, especially for our kids, to model a real open-mindedness that allows them to make up their own mind.
Let me share with you a couple of emails and Facebook comments that have come in over the course of the hour. Karen in Charlotte writes, your guest just said, it's all about giving your kids the tools and the information to decide for themselves. But in my experience growing up Catholic, that certainly isn't what most major organized religious institutions do. Never did I hear, or do I now, anyone who is a member of a faith group say anything that suggests even remotely that their gospel is just one idea of how things might be, and that actually the Muslims, the Jews, the Universalists, the Humanists, the Buddhists, the Atheists, etc., might actually have it right. We do not participate in any organized religion, but I talk often with my kids about what varied religions teach. My children are welcome to attend services and youth group activities with their friends, which they have done. Left on their own with these opportunities for exploration, neither of them in their 12 and 14 has discovered any truth beyond the one we live. I think the default position, faith in a superhuman being or not, pretty much determines what your kids will believe. I'm opposed to brainwashing kids at a young age. If there is a God, he, she, it will find a way to reach my kids without the intervention of religious authorities acting in their own best interests.
Well, I don't know if I could say it better myself. I think that's a great comment. Look, I'm not arguing that taking your joining a church or subscribing to a certain denomination or religion is going to give your kids the tools to make up their minds themselves. I think this parent is doing it the right way. My point is, it shouldn't be a taboo. It shouldn't be something that's off limits for children. They need to understand it, whether it means occasionally going to services with a friend or family member.
Go to services occasionally, don't you?
We do.
Christmas and times like that?
That's right.
Where do you go? What kind of a church do you go to?
We have gone to churches in our area that we're comfortable with, Episcopal, Presbyterian, Catholic churches. I would like to expose my kids to a wider range, and we just have not done that.
Why?
Yet. But part of this is, again, culturally, we're Christians. We celebrate Christmas in my family.
Uh-huh. And but do you believe it?
Do I believe what?
In the birth of the Son of God, the divinity of Jesus, the fact that he rose again from the dead after being crucified. Do you believe all that?
No, I think it's clear in my book that I don't believe all that, or I don't at least believe that we can know the truth of what about
such
things.
So why go? I asked John Dominic Crossan this question. He's a former Catholic priest and a member of the Jesus Seminar. And this is a group of people who genuinely want to find out the truth about the historical Jesus, who this person was as a human being and what he actually did say and what he actually didn't say. Whether or not that can really be done, I don't know. But I asked him that question, and because he does not believe in any of the things, any of the tenets. He does not believe that Christ was divine. Christ never said he was. He does not believe that Christ rose again from the dead. He does not believe he was the Son of God. Does not believe that he turned the water into wine. None of it.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. Well, why do you believe? I said. And he said, because what's the alternative? Well, there are plenty of alternatives. Why do you, if you don't believe it, why go to church? Why take your children? Why expose them to something that you don't believe in?
Right. And I think, you know, the issue of the divinity of Christ would certainly separate many, you know, would keep a lot of people out of many congregations, especially in this part of the country, if you didn't come down on the side that the church believed in,
mm-hmm.
didn't come down believing in the divinity of Christ. This is my whole point, is that the reason is to look at the full breadth of what religion is
but
in
why?
Our society.
Why?
Because if you ignore it, it is you're ignoring something that could ultimately, either for bad or for good, change your life or your kid's life. You could change their life because of conflict in the world that is based on two different societies' understanding of how the world came to be and what rules the world.
Well, then why not take them to a mosque?
I'm all for that. I'm all for that. And we haven't done that yet. But my point is not just to expose them to Christianity, but I think expose them to all religions to help them understand the context that religious beliefs come about in, and that they're one thing that's fascinating to me is the similarities, the commonalities between religions across cultures, across historical eras. I think kids have to understand that, but they don't have to necessarily, what I'm opposed to is them understanding it because daddy says religion is all hooey and that we don't need to know about that.
Mm-hmm. Jessica writes, my husband and I were both raised Catholic, but now could be best described as agnostic. We do have different ideas about the holiday. Since I do not identify myself as a Christian, I do not feel comfortable participating in traditional Christmas activities. But my husband has no problem celebrating Christmas. And they were curious about what you do in your home. We've already talked about it a little bit. But do you celebrate Christmas as a religious holiday? Do you have a creche? I mean, do you talk about the birth of the baby Jesus? Or do you celebrate it as with the Christmas tree and the lights and the tinsel and the presents and Santa Claus?
We celebrate it with both, again, because I think it would be dishonest to ignore why people in our society celebrate Christmas for the most part. It doesn't mean that I am teaching my kids that this is the truth or this is not the truth. But I think it's important for them to understand that story and understand the context. And as we celebrate, the things that we're celebrating, I think, are the byproducts of that.
I know that you say that you have this Christian patina about you, and that's why you do that. But you don't talk about Hanukkah? You don't celebrate Hanukkah?
We talk about Hanukkah. We don't celebrate Hanukkah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
I have 1,000 calls here. Let me put your headphones on. We don't have a lot of time here, but let me try to get to some of them very quickly. June in Belmont, welcome.
Hi. Good morning. Thank
morning.
You for the show. I'm enjoying it a lot. I was telling the person that took the call, I was raised very fundamentalist. I'm an older person, but I never went to bed a night in my life that I didn't, as a child, worry that I would wake up in hell. And I would see pictures of Jesus, and I was taught that how he died for my sins, and don't you feel ashamed and guilty, and that what Jesus did for you. And it has really influenced my life in a very, very negative way. And with my grandchildren especially, I have run into some hard questions when they were little, asking me what I believed, especially about Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
I can have no problem saying, yes, I think we have to. I think there's a God, maybe, you know. But we're surrounded by Christianity everywhere. And it's just, I really appreciate the show, and I appreciate the man's grandfather who couldn't even take a walk. So I understand why he couldn't do that.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. Thank you for your call. I appreciate it, June. Thank you. Let me go to Tom in York, South Carolina. Very quickly, Tom, because we're short on time.
Yes. I'd like to ask the gentleman about considering the why of religion rather than the what. If you look at religion as meditation and fantasy rather than fact and reality, it makes a lot more sense. To me, anyway.
Okay. Any comment on that?
I mean, that's an interesting point, and I think, meditation is not a bad thing. Contemplation is not a bad thing, and there is some something to be perhaps gained there for non-believers to think about how to be as contemplative as many religious people are. Mm-hmm. Because that's certainly something that can be a benefit in people's lives.
Thank you for your call, Tom. I have 30 seconds left. One area of concern for every good parent is how to teach a child to live a good life, how to lead ethical lives. And also, I would think, coming to terms with death, which is a tough topic for anybody. And that role has been filled mostly by religion. So in the absence of faith, how do you do that?
Well, two things. I think that, you know, a lot of our ethical judgments are a lot more matter of fact than we say that they are. I don't think that you need to be a religious person to believe that, you know, we should treat others as we want to be treated. And I don't know anyone who's come to terms entirely with death, whether they're religious or not.
Andrew Park talks about all of this in his book, about his search for how to explain all this to his children, his book called Between a Church and a Hard Place. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mike.